Welcome to Thoughts on Record, podcast of the Ottawa Institute of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. I'm your host, Dr. P. Kelly. Each week, we explore topics of interest relevant to mental health clinicians and consumers. That said, if you're generally interested in psychology, the brain, dynamics of human behavior, and other aspects of the incredible journey that is the human experience, you've come to the right place. Now, without further delay, here's today's episode. An Australian psychologist and numbers guy, Dr. Matt Brown is a research professor at psychology at CQU, where he does research on all manner of things, but particularly enjoys looking into why people believe the things they do, religion, conspiracy theories, alternative medicine, and other stuff. He's into social media in the same way people slow down for car accidents. Dr. Chris Kavanaugh is a Northern Irish cognitive anthropologist who occasionally moonlights as a social psychologist. Chris has long-standing interest in the psychology of conspiracy theorists and pseudoscience. His academic research focuses on the cognitive science of religion and ritual psychology. Chris is an associate professor in psychology at RICO University and a researcher at the University of Oxford Center for the Study of Social Cohesion. He lives happily in Japan with his family. Matt and Chris have been hosting the podcast Decoding the Gurus since 2020. All right, Drs. Matt Brown and Chris Kavanaugh, welcome to Thoughts on Record. How are you both doing today?
Good, thank you. Good to be here.
Good. For this time of the morning, good.
Okay, so what I thought I could do, if it's okay with you both, is I wanted to give, I guess, you and the audience just a little bit of a sense of how we've come to have this conversation today, if that's okay. If you can indulge me just for a few moments, that's okay?
Sure.
Wonderful. Okay, so starting in about 2016, I became quite curious about the ascendance of a number of what I'll call for the moment public intellectuals. I'm kind of air quoting here. Folks like Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson, Brett, and Eric Weinstein, among others. And full disclosure, longtime listeners might remember that I had Brett Weinstein on the podcast about 4 years ago. That's a whole other story, but I think that needs to be said for transparency's sake, given the nature of our conversation today. And I think the draw for me initially was the notion of exploring some kind of, you know, in good faith heterodoxy, looking at different ideas and things outside of the norms. However, as time went on, I started to see the language and the ideas and the speech become more radicalized and taking on this really kind of, to my mind, cringy clubhouse kind of vibe with terms like the intellectual dark web getting tossed around. It also seemed to be infused with this kind of like aggrieved narcissism and frankly, at times a really sour mean-spiritedness to my taste. And then of course, COVID hit and the whole thing went totally nuts. And I couldn't quite literally believe the nonsense I was hearing, like conspiracies, pontificating on any number of areas way outside any reasonable scope of expertise, grifting, and it only seems to have got worse from there, as far as I can tell. So one weekend not too long ago, I was sitting around and I thought, okay, like surely others have noted this descent into insanity that has taken place here over the past 10 years. And a quick Google search later, and I found your podcast, and wow, it was super cathartic. I felt like you both completely nailed it. I've been consuming it and really just sort of integrating it. It's almost sort of like restored my sanity on some level in terms of wondering how it all went so wrong. In any case, I felt really compelled to reach out to you to have a discussion on our podcast around the rise of the guru. In particular, I think there'd be a lot of value in walking through your garometer, which we'll talk about, but essentially a checklist for evaluating guru potential, and then have a bit of a broader discussion around the modern secular guru. So that's a big mouthful. Thanks for indulging me. I know there's a bunch of items I'd love to get your take on, so why don't we jump right in?
Yeah. By the way, Pete, just to say, from our experience talking about and with gurus, that was a very short monologue. So you don't need to feel self-conscious. If it 10 minutes is usually perfectly fine in the guru sphere. So yeah, you could go on. We are fine.
So what I'm hearing is that I'm not on my way to being decoded. Is that correct?
No, you're safe for now. No offense, but you're no Sam Harris in the monologuing department. We came to this a little bit with the same motivation as yourself, in that we'd simply been online and noticed the shape that the discourse was taking, and noticed a particular role that certain figures seemed to be having. So Chris and I got to talking. He's an anthropologist. My background's in psychology. We both look at things through an academic, I suppose, research-oriented sort of lens. And we had a fair few criticisms and concerns about these gurus too. But I think although there were a lot of other people online taking shots at these people, generally people are coming at it from a political point of view, in the sense that, you know, they're too right-wing, or in a few cases they're much too left-wing, or, you know, they've got a big problem with their take on such and such. And, you know, you can do that, that's fine. But for us, the interesting thing was the psychology of it, the anthropology of it, the social dynamics of what was going on. And you mentioned narcissism, also a fair bit of conspiracism as well. So there's a lot of connections to topics that psychologists and anthropologists find really interesting.
Chris, did you want to weigh in on why you started the podcast, or the ethos around Decoding the Gurus?
Yeah, I think Matt did a pretty good job of summarizing the main points. The only thing I'd add is that Matt had a previous interest in looking at conspiracy communities in terms of anti-vaxxers and flat earth communities. And for myself, I had a long-term interest in the kind of skeptical community, traditional skeptical community, so stuff around alternative health, but also conspiracy communities. And so long before looking at the current crop of secular gurus, I was listening to various conspiracy theorists and alternative medicine communities and some podcasts where people are talking about it, and kind of mentally doing what Matt and I have ended up doing and recording. So that is to say, it's a pathology that I think I've had for a long time before focusing on Brett Weinstein and Jordan Peterson and stuff. So they're doing slightly different things, but there's a lot of continuity in those kind of content.
So it sounds like you had a framework sort of in place in advance that allowed you to maybe frame up this phenomenon maybe a little bit earlier than other folks. Is that a fair? That's my words, not yours, but does that sound fair?
Well, I think a lot of people were, I think if you go back, there's always people being critical about those kind of communities, you know, like famously Carl Sagan and so on. But perhaps the thing which is slightly different, which I think now is becoming its own thing that we can maybe talk about, is that listening to the content or consuming the material of conspiracy theorists or secular gurus, that's something that a lot of people don't tend to do, you know, because quite frankly, it's annoying, right? And I think people have a relatively healthy, low tolerance for listening to stuff that they find annoying. But I don't share that tendency. I listen to many things that annoy me greatly. So in that sense, I was doing that to myself from an early stage. And yeah, it's now a little bit more common because you do get like content which is focused on critically evaluating stuff, right? That seems to be more common now. But yeah, I would say it was early to that trend, but not early to looking critically at conspiracy theories and alternative medicine.
What I think is really interesting is you very deliberately have chosen to focus on secular gurus. And perhaps you'd want to contrast that with some of the other gurus that are out there. So I guess, what is a secular guru from your perspective, and why this particular focus?
Yeah, it's a good question. The term guru, people usually associate with being some kind of spiritual or religious teacher, right? Although, you know, you could, I'm known as a stats guru, statistics guru in my university. So it's got a broader, it's got a broader meaning as well. But we thought that these people that we're interested in are a bit different. Like, you know, you have Deepak Chopra, who's into the spiritual stuff, or you've got your sort of classic 1960s, 70s counterculture, perhaps Indian type guru. But the interesting thing about characters like Jordan Peterson or a Sam Harris is that they're very much coming from a secular point of view. But we have a theory, I suppose, a hypothesis that they're essentially fulfilling the same function that your more traditional guru, prophet type figure would have. So it's interesting that while a traditional guru might make lay claim to epistemic and moral authority via a kind of revealed truth, a revelation that they've had, that they've been up the mountain, they've got the stone tablets or whatever. A secular guru is actually making recourse to our secular institutions, being an intellectual, being an academic, being, you know, references to science. But the concern for us, and the reason why we think it's in many ways an unhealthy phenomena, is that they're generally doing these things in a very performative way. So while they might be citing, you know, this little study found that, and, you know, theory tells us this, you'll notice yourself that the claims that they make from that are extremely sweeping, extremely broad. They get right above their skis. And in fact, they're not applying academic, intellectual, or scientific thinking properly, but they're giving the very good appearance of doing so. So we have this idea of a garometer, which is just our checklist, really, a set of themes, I suppose, that we tend to spot there. And, you know, a lot of it revolves around essentially being not quite what they appear. It's not what's inside is not quite what's on the tin.
Yeah, and I'd say the distinction that Matt made about sourcing their authority in secular modes of knowledge, even in the case of, you know, Jordan Peterson is one of the most preeminent members of the secular guru category, but he often will make reference to religion and religious symbolism and that kind of thing. But even in that case, it's usually presented as a psychological or evolutionary interpretation of religion, as opposed to a kind of mystical insight. So that is the distinction, because it is certainly the case, and increasingly recently, that a number of the more right-leaning gurus have started to come out as religious or endorse religiosity. But that doesn't actually count against it, because we are more focused on the way that they are engaging with the kind of traditions and sources of knowledge that they cite. So yeah, it is kind of revealed knowledge, but through claims to be special through secular insights for the most part. But a lot of it functions, like Matt says, that the reason that we're using the term guru is because when you compare them to traditional gurus or religious or spiritual gurus, a lot of the techniques are actually very similar. It's just the references that change, but the underlying logic is often like very, very similar.
I want to take a stroll through the garometer in a moment, because I think this is a really nice segue to going through that. I have a question for you first. You know, with the caveat, this is pure speculation on all of our parts, I would say, although perhaps maybe you feel more definitively about it. Do you think the average secular guru is sitting there in complete belief of what they think and what they're saying? Do they believe what they're saying? Or do you believe it's a crafted message of which they might be arm's length or have absolutely no resonance with it, but know cynically that it's something that's going to further their ends or their means? So how premeditated do you think it is? Do you think it is versus really just almost a delusional self-belief around some of these things?
That's a perennial question. We get asked that one a lot. So there's probably a spectrum. I could think of figures like Constantin Kissin, for instance, who is very clearly a business person, a careerist, someone who is very much focused on optimizing metrics and talks about that quite frankly. So, and then you have figures, I think like Jordan Peterson would be a good example there, that are true believers, that they are a kind of prophet, that they are or have a special role to play in this world. And if there is a lot of financial or social benefits accruing to him doing that, I'm sure he would perceive it as this is the natural outcome of him being such a special and important person. So I think while it might seem to be a dichotomy, that kind of mad or bad dichotomy, are they pretending or are they in good faith, shall we say, but a bit crazy? I don't think there's a real dichotomy there at all. Actually, you know, through cognitive dissonance or whatever, people align their self-concept. Nobody can, I think, consciously lie very well for long periods of time. It's a lot easier to actually drink the Kool-Aid yourself, believe your own bullshit, and that way you're simply a much more effective communicator. You have to have that self-belief. So that's my take on it. Would you agree, Chris?
Yeah, I think that, there are people that are outright swindlers and, confidence tricksters or those kind of things. But that kind of person is rare, like Peter Popoff, the kind of infamous televangelist.
Televangelist,
yeah, who was receiving like audio information and presenting it as if he was receiving it from God, right? He was receiving it from his wife. James Randi famously documented that. But in that case, that's knowingly lying, right? So, and I agree with Matt that is rarer. In general, and also in the secular guru space, but I do think that there is the case, like if you take someone like Constantine that Matt mentioned, there is a focus on metrics, on growing an audience, and on tailoring the message and your content in such a way that it appeals. But simultaneously, there is a growing belief especially as your audience grows, that you are an important figure with something meaningful to say, and that you are not just adopting positions to pander to your audience. In fact, most of the secular gurus will constantly tell their audience that they are the ones willing to go against the grain, to speak truth to their audience, even when it's obvious that that's not the case. But I think that people are complex and can hold many different things in their head at the same time and compartmentalize different things. So there might be cases where people are knowingly lying and misrepresenting things or selectively reporting things. But I think in most cases, there's a healthy degree of self-delusion that helps push things along.
I have a tiny little addendum, which is a bit of a preview of the Garometer, which is that I think we both think that narcissism is a trait that you tend to see in these gurus. And it does take a certain kind of superhuman level of self-belief to do the kinds of things that these characters do. I mean, Donald Trump is a great example. He, in a way, his proclivity to lie and spout absolute bullshit ad infinitum is a kind of superpower, because it allows him to do things with such confidence that normal people cannot. So I think if you are higher in that trait, I'm talking about the spectrum here, not the clinical diagnosis. I think if you're higher in that trait, then you do not see much daylight between what's in your best interests and what is sort of objectively true, whether or not you want to believe it or not. So I think the narcissism helps.
Yeah, I think those are great points. It can't help having millions of people on Twitter or whatever platform also applauding your every move. I mean, that's got to be a huge amplifier where you are able to sort of distort reality around you, probably not getting great feedback, probably get in an echo chamber, all the things that you would assume that would come with that. You just imagine this kind of feed forward intensification kind of loop that happens there.
Yeah. Yeah. Social media is like pouring gasoline onto a narcissism fire.
Yeah. All right. So why don't we start going through the Garometer a little bit? And for those scoring at home, what is your recommended scoring rubric here as we go through the different parameters?
Chris, would you like to lead us off, or shall I?
Well, so in terms of the scoring rubric, we have 10 factors that we identified as recurrent. We are sometimes debating about adding or combining different ones, but generally speaking, The 10 that we've identified, we think are significant, though we don't make claim they're all equally significant, but the scoring does, right? We score everyone from 1 to 5 on each of them and then convert that into an overall score. But in large part, when we were making the Garometer, it was in part because when we covered people on the show, although there are like commonalities, there were often people that are doing some component of the secular guru archetype and some parts not so much. And we wanted to feel a bit more comfortable about covering people and about highlighting that distinction, right? That we're not simply saying there is a binary secular guru and not category. It's more of a spectrum. And one thing that we have noticed over time, perhaps was obvious at the start, but like while you could be a secular guru and be relatively harmless, like you could fit within the archetype, the broad category, if you score high on the 10 factors that we've identified, you're basically not a very good, in terms of your effect on discourse or the way that you interact with people, it is quite manipulative and negatively valent. So scoring high on the Garometer is a little bit like you are a toxic secular guru. Whereas scoring low probably can mean that either you don't really fit the template well, but it can also mean that you are like you do fit as a secular guru, but you're not doing anything particularly toxic. So it could be toxic Garometer measure. Anything you would add to that?
No, Chris is right. It's meant to be not an index of how much we like someone or think that they're fundamentally correct or not, but rather we wanted to find a bit better. So I'll run through them very quickly just because there are 10 of them. So we don't want to chew up all of our time. But very briefly, the first one, we call it tongue-in-cheekly galaxy brainness. That's this presenting yourself as a polymath, being an expert at everything, having this special wisdom that is like super deep and beyond what normal mortals can comprehend. We make reference to cultishness, which is an idea that's floating around there. It's basically being on, not being a bona fide cult leader necessarily, but those cultish social dynamics, using flattery, punishing people in your in-group that kind of step out of line, being super charitable to your friends and allies, but then, in building up those parasocial bonds with your audience, but very much setting it up as an in-group, out-group type thing where the outsiders are all evil. Anti-establishmentarianism, they generally, basically the institutions are all wrong. They're all lying to you, if not totally evil. It's hard to find a proper guru that actually thinks Anthony Fauci is okay. Grievance mongering is an important one. They often do have a tale of personal grievance, like a trial by fire. They've been victimized by the authorities. Jordan Peterson, Brett Weinstein, Eric Weinstein, most of our top gurus have that personal narrative, but they also, people like Scott Adams, for instance, like that, encourage their audience in a sense of grievance. It's connected with the anti-establishmentarianism. This is what they took from us. This is the kind of oppression that they're trying to bring in. We already mentioned narcissism. We've got one. It's a minor one, but we call it the Cassandra complex. There is like an intellectual hook to what the gurus provide. And sometimes it's not all bad, right? Sometimes, one of the good things about social media and independent broadcasting generally is it does allow you to do deep dives and talk about, obscure niche topics just like we're doing now. But gurus also need that emotive hook, right? The thing that gets you in the guts, the sort of red meat to go along with the sort of cognitive side of things. So warning of the dangers to come. Things are going to hell in a handbasket, according to the gurus, pretty quickly. You need to listen to them and get their message in order to be able to handle what's coming. that they often claim to have revolutionary theories. Famously, some of our favorite gurus, have claimed that I think about five people in their, both them and their family members and close friend networks are all deserving of Nobel Prizes. Gad Saad, for instance, makes a big deal about how he's revolutionized the field of economic psychology, consumer psychology. Pseudo-profound bullshit, another term which sounds colloquial but is actually a serious topic of study, which is that use of language to present the form of deep intellectual substance without necessarily having anything underneath it. And you can do that quite easily if you have the gift of the gab. You can invent technical terms, neologisms, being able to wax lyrical, perhaps using that evocative metaphorical language. Again, Jordan Peterson is a master at this. But also that scientism, as we talked about, making recourse to scientific citations, scientific references, as if what they're saying, they're often just spinning their wheels or talking off the top of their head, but they give the impression that it is grounded in this sort of technical scientific literature that you, the audience, just don't know about, but that they do. Finally, very quickly, conspiracy mongering. We can talk about conspiracies in more detail later. And the final red flag, you can call it excessive profiteering or you could call it grifting. It's not necessary, I suppose, but they often do aggressively monetize their activities. There's nothing wrong, of course, with making money per se. It's nothing wrong with doing social media, public communication as a job and to be paid for it, but aggressively monetizing it, particularly shilling supplements. There is something about supplements which it seems to be a thing that certain people choose to do. So that's it.
Well, I tried to secure an AG1 sponsorship for this episode, but they didn't come through in time, unfortunately.
Chris has been being sent cans of, what are you getting sent, Chris, by Chris?
Williamson? Newtonic, his energy drink. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Has that got you off your coffee yet? I recall that was going to be your gateway drug off of caffeine.
Yeah, it was.
Or different kind of caffeine.
It was succeeding. Justin making me not drink coffee, but now instead I've ended up that I consume both coffee and energy drinks, including other branded energy drinks, Monster, that kind of thing. So, no, I added another vice. That was the unfortunate outcome of that arc.
Chris, I think you need to add some Alpha Brain to your stack. I think that's the missing ingredient as far as
Alpha Brain has no caffeine. That's the problem. Anything with caffeine, I will consume. But if you're missing that key ingredient, I'm not interested.
I'm curious, with the garometer, has anyone exposed the ceiling of the scale, or who has scored highest, I guess?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. The ones at the top. So we did one time as part, because we were interviewing a guy, Elgin, who has a podcast about the Unification Church, the Moonies. He's a second generation member, or was an ex-member of the Moonies. And so in part from the episodes we did with Elgin, we went and looked at Reverend Moon's some of his content from the 70s, and so he topped it out because that's cheating a bit, because he was a cult leader.
I'm sure if we covered L. Ron Hubbard,
I think almost all of the actual cult leaders will also top out the score, but that's a bit unfair because we know that. So in terms of the people that have scored very highly that are secular guru types, perhaps non-surprisingly, the two Weinstein brothers are at the tip top. And they were the first two people that we covered and are kind of, I think, archetypical examples of secular gurus. And then you have Robert Malone and Peter McCulloch, two figures that were quite prominent in the anti-vaccine discourse. But it's not their anti-vaccine stance which makes them secular gurus. They do a whole bunch of other things, pretty much everything that Matt just highlighted. And then might surprise people, but people like Joe Rogan score very highly, and Scott Adams. Jordan Peterson now, I also think, would be extremely high. When we covered him originally, we looked at content, I think, from 2018 or 2017. And he still was doing a lot of the same things, but to a tamped down degree. I suspect that if we recoded him now, he would like be way up there at the top on everything. So yeah, that's the kind of people that are touching the heavens when it comes to the scale.
I was thinking about the cultishness. Well, I was thinking about all of them as you're going through. I've noticed a lot on Rogan's podcast as the guests come through, often bringing gifts, offerings, sort of to sort of like the head guru. It's got this very kind of, three wise men kind of deal to it.
There was a post on, it might have originally appeared on 4chan, but I seen it on Reddit where somebody compared Joe Rogan to the Great Khan. Like, okay, science man, now explain why sunrise in the west. So, and I think that comparison is actually, not hugely far off. The history podcast, The Rest is History, was recently covering Martin Luther and the Reformation. And it was interesting because there are a lot of parallels that you can see when you look at historical eras with, the kind of secular guru and just, influencer, spiritual guru figure that I think resonated in history. And I do think that very, tongue-in-cheek image of Joe Rogan sitting on his throne and having people come and perform for him. It's tongue-in-cheek, but it actually speaks to a real dynamic about there being a very clear status differential between Joe Rogan and his guests. And it is very rare that Joe will have someone on that is, directly confrontational or critical of him. And when he did used to have those people on, in most occasions, it was a number of years ago before he reached the levels that he has now. So he tends to not have those experiences now. So yeah, there's definitely a lot in that issue about people pandering.
One group of people I want to ask you about who are sort of, I guess, kind of guru adjacent, but maybe they're trying to elbow their way into the guru sphere would be kind of, I'm thinking, maybe like the Jay Shetty, Chris Williamson, even Rogan, like, people who sort of provide a platform or kind of want to, they have podcasts or trying to make it clearly, hosting a lot of guru types on there. How do they fit into the equation here? Hangers on or what, like wannabe gurus, gurus in the making? What's your conceptualization of those folks?
That's a good question. I don't think Chris and I have really talked about this at length, but off the top of my head, I think there's multiple things going on. There's secular guru phenomena, but that is bound up with and intermeshed with the social media
influencer
phenomenon, which is, a social and a technological phenomenon. So Chris mentioned the historical parallels, say with Martin Luther. Martin Luther certainly had an interesting personality. It's definitely had those iconoclastic tendencies and very loquacious, very debatey, all of those things. But equally, you wouldn't have a figure like that having that kind of influence if it wasn't for the technological innovations that had come along with the printing press and, people being able to read the Bible and other documents firsthand in their native language. So likewise, that's going on now. Everyone knows about this shift to online independent media. There's a lot of good components to it, a lot of excellent content. I consume an awful lot of stuff and I'm very happy with it. But at the same time, it is like the Wild West. And perhaps as a culture, we haven't quite accommodated or adapted to this. So there are, you know, any time there is a situation of great opportunity, that is, you can be like someone like Chris Williamson and set and start your own podcast and essentially independently bypass all of the networks and the editors and all of the institutional gatekeeping that goes on and go straight for the brass ring yourself. And the technology gives that very quick feedback cycle. You have those metrics, you have the download figures and all of that stuff. And if you are focused on optimizing those, then it is going to lead you in a certain direction. So with someone like Chris, like regardless of what his personality is, regardless of what his intentions or whatever are, if someone like him is first and foremost a business person and an ambitious one who wants to be successful, then you will almost naturally have to do certain things. In other words, you will get on a guest, not because you think they're interesting or informative or whatever. You'll get the one because they're controversial, because they're super popular, that it is going to get clicks. So I think the dynamics, so that is going on simultaneously.
Yeah, and I would add that alongside those dynamics, you mentioned like Jay Shetty, and I think in those cases, there's more a kind of direct parallel trajectory to like spiritual gurus or kind of therapeutic figures, right? And Matt and I are doing a series looking at streamer culture, like people like Destiny and Hassan and Dr. K or these people. And there's lots of differences there. You know, there's people that focus on politics. There's people that focus on interpersonal drama, or usually a mixture thereof. But the Jay Shetty kind of Dr. K side of thing, I think, is directly in line with a whole both like basically alternative health and spiritual what's the word, communities or guru figures from the past, just making use of the modern social media environments in kind of innovative ways, or linking it to gaming culture or this kind of thing, or, you know, doing streaming therapeutic sessions or whatever the case might be. So I think there's slightly different dynamics than what is occurring with somebody who has a more like interview oriented show, right? Like Diary of a CEO or Chris Williamson. And in those cases, like Matt said, there's a constant pull to have controversial figures. But I also think that there's a pull in regard to the audience wanting the person that's hosting to also have some profundity to them, and to, you know, so the Weller, they are cultivating, now they're reacting to the incentive for that to be there. The incentive is there that, you know, you should also be kind of offering your own philosophy of life and whatnot. And I think that is a difference than you would see in traditional journalism. You know, like people who interviewed figures in the past, including a whole host of different figures with, you know, extreme views or controversial figures, they weren't typically being presented as they need to be injecting their philosophy. Actually, that would have been seen as getting in the way of what they're supposed to be doing. But the new crop of like secular guru adjacent interviewers, it's actually presented that in itself is a obstacle to getting into a real relationship with someone. Like a podcast should be a friendly discussion where everybody comes out kind of feeling good and, you know, spiritually enlivened. And what it shouldn't be is somebody reading a set of, like, you know, difficult questions about your controversies. And because that's just gotcha journalism. That's not what they're interested in, right? That's what the mainstream media does. So Yeah, the parasocial component and the interpersonal dynamics are given precedence over actually, like, you know, asking people critical questions or dealing with controversies in a more objective way.
So Pete, you're doing this interview all wrong. First of all, you should have been flattering Chris a lot more. You should have been, you know, developing a deep interpersonal bond with me. What's going on?
Yeah.
I've sent gifts, but they're going to take a while to get there. My apologies.
Well, you did say that our podcast was good at the start, so that counts somewhere that counts. Along the way. Yeah.
Now, but look, I mean, I think the other thing I've got in common is, yeah, they're all offering something. They're catering to a need. The standard journalism, when I think of like Helen Lewis, for instance, a friend of ours who interviewed Jordan Peterson once, your standard BBC or network type journalist, they're not trying to build a personal bond with the person they're interviewing. They're not sort of wrapping up with some deep home truths to help you live your life better or anything like that. They're, you know, it's much drier and it doesn't satisfy those kinds of needs. So I think a lot of these guru adjacent topics and figures, they may be talking about politics, they may be in the manosphere teaching, you know, giving young men this sort of like ways to be more attractive to women or to pick up women, or it could be entrepreneurial, like, you know, how do you achieve your goals, how do you solve the problems in your life and min-max life to be a winner. I mean, they're catering to these sort of deep needs that people have in a way that traditional journalism doesn't.
I want to ask you a question again that perhaps could be in the realm of speculation, or maybe you've noticed a pattern as you've been watching things. I want to get a sense maybe of your sense of the natural history of the guru, like the arc of the journey. So if I think about someone like Andrew Huberman, who I've listened to for a while, started off fairly benign, you know, optimization, health, all that kind of good stuff. And I think the cue for me is when he started getting out of his lane a lot, like talking about like having all these different guests on that were clearly not related to his sort of where he's a content matter expert. And obviously anyone who's been paying attention to the news would have heard some of the stuff that's been going on with him recently. So he seems to have kind of been climbing up the garometer slowly but surely. I wonder if that's in general the pattern that you've seen. And I'm also curious to get your speculation about how this all ends typically for the guru. Does it end in tears, or do they sort of get away with it sort of indefinitely, or case by case?
In terms of the trajectory issue, I think that there is that tendency which you described, and it depends on the figure, but generally speaking, that people will start out with a more restricted and caveated presentation of the topics that they're talking about. And even if they themselves hold some more out there ideas, they tend to be more reticent to promote that, right? Or present it in less extreme forms. I think Jordan Peterson perfectly exemplifies that, because if you look at Jordan Peterson's material, it's always been like, you know, making these big leaps in logic, connecting world religion and, you know, philosophy and history and kind of jumping around topics. But he was more careful previously to caveat his claims, and he more avoided directly stating things. And now he's, you know, absolutely no hesitation to just repeat the most unhinged conspiracism kind of morally crusade in a way. He was always prone to that, but his crusade against the Ontario College of Physicians or Therapists, whatever it is, his licensing body, if you compare that to his initial public crusade against Bill C-16 in Canada, the level of bombast is much less, right, in the original one. So there definitely is a ramping up. But the one point I would note, and it kind of speaks, I think, to the narcissism point, that when you go back and look at earlier content or before many of the figures who are secular gurus became famous, what they were up to before. There are often very clear indicators that they are not just like everybody else in terms of their output and sense of their own importance. In many respects, they're gurus in waiting. Like, they believe that they should be in the international conversation. They should be forefront leaders in whatever discipline they're involved in. And they're often very frustrated that they're not, and are making constant attempts to get media attention or professional status or these kind of things. And so, yeah, in that respect, I think sometimes to the public, it looks like there's been this huge arc. But in some respects, it is, I think, the public display of the character more directly than the person completely changing. But that said, it is certainly the case that you find that over time, almost all of the gurus become more extreme, more polemical, and that kind of thing. So it isn't like nothing changes.
Yeah, I'd sign on to all of that. I have another thought there too, though, which is that we see their increasing confidence and an increasing degree of going more extreme. But I think in a material sense, if they'd started off like that, like ranting and raving about X, Y, and Z at the very beginning of the career, then they wouldn't have developed the broad popularity that they have. And I can see sort of a material incentive there, which is that when you are starting out, then you want to cast your net wide. You want to appeal to as broad a section of people as possible and build up that kind of audience. But then once you kind of get there and you've got that groundswell, I think there is an incentive to become more extreme, I guess narrow your appeal so that you may actually lose a lot of more moderate, more normal kind of people in your audience, but you get a lot more passionate adherence amongst those people who are further along the spectrum, I suppose, or further along the path, and those people are the ones that I think you can monetize a lot more. Like, these are the people that will pay $500 to have a one-on-one, you know, session. These are the people that will subscribe to quite expensive monthly things or attend your bespoke university that you've created or whatever. So I can see some sort of very material motivations there for there being a benefit to a guru that once they achieve a certain degree of notoriety, of fame or whatever, to then kind of exploit their popularity by going more extreme.
And there's one bit I'd add to that, Matt, that after you've reached a certain level of popularity and fame, like take Huberman, for example, it no longer becomes hugely consequential if you are reprimanded by a licensing body or you're removed from a university position or that kind of thing, because it matters in the sense that that is part of your legitimacy. Like, most of the gurus, at the same time as they're disparaging academia or mainstream media or whatever the case might be, they'll constantly still reference their credentials as like being significant, right? So you can, in some sense, remove the pillar that they are associated with, Harvard or Stanford or whoever it might be, or have credentials. But once they have reached the stage that they have millions of listeners, they have download metrics that show millions of people are listening to the material, they're now fabulously wealthy, millionaires, right? They don't actually require the institution's support. And so Huberman is still associated with Stanford, right? And it's actually, I think, in at least until recently, has been a mutually beneficial arrangement. But he has no financial need anymore for his position at Stanford, right? His income from his podcast and advertising would vastly outstrip any income from his position. So his position at the university is purely because he wants to continue it. And same with Jordan Peterson's association with Toronto, right? Before, many, many years ago, even before he had the issue with, you know, his addiction and going, getting put into an induced coma and whatnot. When his Patreon figures were public, I believe he was making $70,000 just from Patreon per month, right? $70,000. And he became more popular, right? So that at that stage, your position at the university being removed, although Jordan reels against it and all those kind of things, it has no material impact. And they will often reference that people are criticizing me, but millions of people watched my most recent episode, or we got 400,000 people who are signed up for this. And Jordan Peterson actually on a couple of occasions has equated view counts to the number of people that agree with him. So he'll say, you know, but 2 million people agree with me because some video has 2 million views. So that is also one thing that we noticed, that you might think that as you become hugely wealthy, hugely popular, an international celebrity, that you wouldn't be so reliant on validation from things like your YouTube view numbers. But almost all of the gurus will constantly make reference to their metrics in the way that, you know, you might imagine like a YouTuber who's trying to develop would. So I don't think it ever fills the hole for a certain kind of people. So yeah, that was a long-winded answer, but hopefully some of it was relevant.
Yeah, it makes me a little depressed actually considering this, because I'm thinking a parallel might be Trump, right? Like I always kind of wonder, okay, what does that dude need to do to shed followers or his core? And it seems like there's nothing. No matter what he does, no matter how many criminal charges are brought against him, there's just a subset of the population that projects onto him something that they need or something, and they're ironclad in their loyalty to him. And he could probably just ride that indefinitely. If he lived 200 years, I'm sure he would have those folks with him for 200 years. What I hear maybe implicitly in what you're saying is it might be the same with these guru folks, where they have their core group of followers and they're gonna go all the way to the end, whatever that end might be.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is where the conspiracism and the cultish dynamics comes into play. Because once you have a following with such a high degree of loyalty and adherence, then a lot like a conspiracy, it becomes like a hermetic, self-sealing view of the world. There is really nothing that someone from outside could say about you, or any kind of evidence or whatever that could come to light that could break people's loyalty to you, because, you know, they're all out to get you, obviously, right? They want to stop you because they hate you, and they and I'm telling you the truth. So I think Trump's fans, just like the, you know, some crazy church, like the First Baptist, whatever, the very strange little religious groups, they have the same degree of conspiracism and cultishness and in-group, out-group stuff going on. So they may lose people at the margins, you know, people that had a sort of a, you know, just a general interest in this kind of thing and were toying around with them, but they're probably not going to lose many people from their core constituency, and indeed they'll probably gain more people who feel alienated and aggrieved in their own lives.
Yeah, one point to add there as well is that most of the gurus, especially if they are aware that some criticism is coming, but even in the case that they're not, they present mainstream institutions, journalists, critics in general as being corrupt, bad faith. And so they preempt the audience to expect that they will receive criticism from these sources, and that is a validation. So then when a piece comes out, which is critical, it's presented as a hit piece, right? And as a validation that they now I'm getting too close to the truth. So you can see the fact that I told you they're going to try and attack me, and now they're starting to come out. Russell Brand did it. Huberman is doing it in a slightly less direct way than Russell Brand. Like, Russell Brand released a video before the allegations were released, specifically saying, no, they're going to release a hit piece on me. But it's all of that where there's kind of a Kafka-esque trap where if there is any criticism, it simply proves that the person is correct. And there are fans for whom that doesn't work. Like, if you go on Andrew Huberman's subreddit at the minute, you will see quite a lot of people reacting that the revelations about the way that he was treating the women, but also things about inventing, you know, his personal narrative and some details not lining up, that these damaged their image and they're actually have been caused to reconsider. But you can also see, especially in the Joe Rogan, like more kind of bro science reactionary side of things, that they are completely taking it as a vindication, and that nobody with any credibility would care about this stupid little hit piece. So in that respect, and some people looked at the audience dynamics and saw that, you know, Huberman's subscriptions have went up or whatever. But what I think that actually is there are people leaving, there are people lending less credibility, but they're being replaced by an audience which is more committed, more biased towards certain perspectives. And that in turn will then lead to Huberman, whoever it is, getting more reinforcement for, you know, taking certain kinds of political stances or this kind of thing. So yeah, it's a reinforcing thing, but it's almost impossible for somebody who's established as a guru to be invalidated in the eyes of their audience. And I think that is also the case when it comes to like traditional cult leaders, even when they're exposed, right? Like you can get people who leave, but you will get many people who just remain loyal and regard everything as like an attack.
Yeah, there's probably too much cognitive dissonance at a certain point that you would need to resolve, right? So you've got to go one way or another. So it's like, well, I couldn't be that wrong, could I? So you go all in on, nope, like everything status quo, let's not challenge that.
Yeah, and yeah. Actually, oh, sorry, Matt, go ahead.
No, we're going to say the same thing. But, you know, we receive emails sometimes and we get contacted by people who were a big fan of some guru or other. And they write us a very nice note saying, look, I'm kind of, you know, I've really changed my perspective on these things. And I'm a bit embarrassed that I was so into it for so long. And so on one hand, it's very nice to see those kinds of things. But on the other hand, like they've had to suffer quite a bit, right? Because they've had to, you know, like we all do, eat humble pie from time to time and realize that, look, gee, I was really taken for a ride for a long time. That's a difficult thing for most people to do. So I agree with you. It is hard and somewhat rare for people to be able to do that.
And I was just going to add a slightly different point, which was that amongst the gurus and influencer types themselves, they often hugely value their interpersonal relationship. So if they have had good experiences with someone, they then regard any negative information as like kind of, yeah, being an attack or being an irrelevance, and they'll more prioritize, well, I have known Andrew or Russell for, you know, 5 years, and they've always been very kind and reasonable and thoughtful with me. I've never seen them do anything. So, like, it's very much the interpersonal elevated over the, you know, the actual things that people are doing or promoting or whether there's substance to them. And this seems to get a lot of people in trouble, that they prioritize like the ability to have a nice meal with someone as indicating a fundamental goodness to them that, you know, is more important than whether they're peddling like pseudoscience or yeah, exploiting their audience or whatever the case might be.
Of course, gurus can't exist in a vacuum. They need an audience, right? So do you think that gurus might just be a screen on which we project some sort of underlying need, or do they conjure up some sort of need in us, some sort of latent programming that we may not otherwise express itself? Or is it some bad combination of both, like a lock and a key, sort of like finding each other? What do you think about? Because I'm really curious, but yes, there's gurus and they're interesting to understand, of course, but I think they also tell us something about us as well. And I think that's a really important question.
Oh, for sure. I'd vote for lock and key in terms of those choices. Like Chris has really highlighted to me that that role of a shaman or a guru is a functional role. Like it might have some metaphysical beliefs or some particularities associated with it. It might be performative, but it's performing a function, a social function, satisfying a need. And that's true in traditional type pre-modern societies or groups, and it's true in modern groups. And it isn't a coincidence that topics like health, like culture war, political topics, like how to be successful and make a lot of money, how especially for men, how to find women and get them to sleep with you, right? Like it's no coincidence that these are the topics that gurus tend to serve, because they speak to existential, you know, quite base, I guess, concerns for any you know, clever monkey living on planet Earth. So yeah, I mean, they are catering to a particular need. They're looking to fill a particular void. Look, everyone has to deal with existential problems in their life, and I think you can do it. You can do it in a healthy way or an unhealthy way. And I guess that there's nothing wrong with catering to those needs per se, I suppose. But the issue is when it's like junk food for the soul, right? When the solutions that are proposed are very satisfying, are very emotively appealing. They scratch the itch, but if they're not real, if they don't have sustenance to them, then the overall effect is probably not going to be a healthy one.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the dynamics that the gurus are making use of are like fundamental features of human psychology that, you know, you're not going to get humans to stop being impressed whenever people are speaking so loquaciously. And the, you know, there's a Dan Sperber wrote about this thing, the guru effect, which was talking about the fact that, you know, if you create the impression of profundity and depth, that is how people will often receive it, regardless of the actual level of profundity or depth there. And I think that is absolutely true. And he was writing that about that in the 90s, but that's being talked about, you know, if you go back and look at ancient philosophical debates in Greek or Roman times, or in, you know, China or Japan, people are complaining about the same kind of figures. And it's often claimed that, like, now we're in a unique meaning crisis, right? People are feeling isolated and depressed, and modern life is not satisfying existential concerns. But, like, when you look at history, that people feel disconnected and atomized is a very recurrent complaint, right? You had the New Thought movement, you had the hippie movement, you had the theosophists. If you go back, like, way back in history, you have, you know, the Buddha and the Sramana movements, you have Jesus and various like preachers giving the good news, or, you know, so in all those cases, people are giving people messages to deal with existential angst and feeling that their lives lack meaning. And I think that's that's a common feature. And it doesn't mean that there aren't aspects to the modern social environment or modern technology that exacerbate things in ways that previously haven't been the case. But it is definitely the case that people always are looking for figures that will give them a kind of structure to life, metaphysical insights, mysterical or esoteric knowledge, and kind of explain their psychology to them, right? So I think in that respect, the secular gurus are a modern incarnation of like a recurrent archetype, and it's going to recur in 100 years into the future, unfortunately, as well. Maybe we'll all be online jellyfish or whatever, but there will be a jellyfish guru around.
I have a completely speculative thought here, Chris. Just correct me if you think I'm off base here, but I mean, it is just an idea. But I think although existential concerns are perennial, the nature of them obviously tend to change depending on culture and technology and society. And I can imagine like a pre-modern shaman or guru might be often speaking to existential concerns that are very much about like survival, like will the rains come in the next season, right? Will you know, how do we placate the gods, right? So these terrible things don't happen, because they lived in a world at the mercy of the natural environment to a large degree. This is a very natural concerns. Today we don't have those kinds of concerns, but you know, we do live in these liberal secular democracies where people do have quite a lot of opportunities, but the competition for people is very high. So I think most people feel a lot of pressure in many respects to satisfy these sort of higher order needs, I suppose, to be successful and to be seen as successful, to not just not get sick, but to be healthy, like really healthy. We have these particularly modern existential concerns that we've moved on. They may not be the same ones that people have experienced historically, but you know, we're just poor biological beings, so we're always going to have them.
Yeah. So the only pushback I would give to that is like, it's absolutely the case if you're, you know, concerned about satisfying basic fundamental needs that you're going to have, you know, like different levels of concern and different societies being more or less comfortable or having more or less social obligations are going to put different degrees that you can spend time, you know, engaging in existential angst. But you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, when was that from? The 50s or so? And I'm not talking about the empirical basis of it, but I'm talking about this notion that man has base needs, or humans have base needs, and then have these higher order concerns, right? That if you go back and look at like old philosophy, that is also very commonly a motif that, you know, once you're satisfied in this respect, even in kind of treatises about rulers, right, and how they need to behave in order to like kind of properly embody the way or whatever the case might be. So yes, I do think there is a specific thing to the modern environment and to living in societies where, for the most part, people are, you know, comfortable to a degree that people were not historically. And they have more choices and more options than before. So there can be more feeling of disenchantment that you are not, you know, succeeding or that kind of thing. But I think that there's still a lot of connection there with the kind of concerns that people have had historically, maybe just expressed differently. Because like, you're right that if you're feeling unspiritually satisfied and you're, you know, a very wealthy, highly educated person, that this is a particular kind of concern, right? But there is still, in the year 2024, people who get ill or family members, you know, die, and they search for the reason that happened to them. Like, what is the, what are the unseen forces that caused this? Is there something in me that made this happen? So yeah, that's all I would say is like, I think that still exists, and it's part of the reason that like spiritual and religious traditions are still very popular.
I think quite interestingly, you provide a right to reply option, and we're basically, my understanding is that if someone wants to come on to rebut anything that you've said, they have that capacity, if I'm not mistaken. And I mean, maybe it's just obvious, maybe I'm overthinking it, but why do you think more gurus haven't taken you up on the offer to come on and provide a rebuttal. It seems to me the inherent narcissism and the narcissistic injury that a decoding might evoke would draw them like moths to a flame. Or do you think they're more savvy than that? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, firstly, you shouldn't overestimate our reach. many of our gurus that we cover are very famous people, and I think in many cases we're just literally beneath their notice. We're one of many people who have criticized them in one way, shape, or form, and in many respects, it makes sense to simply ignore those criticisms by and large. Yeah, I mean, some gurus do come on, and there's a subset that we very much enjoy, the sense makers. It's a community of rationalists, or I'm not quite sure how to describe them.
Non-rationalists.
But anyway, I don't know how to, spiritual something, I don't know. But anyway, they have a bit of a different point of view. Like, they're generally not as famous as some of the big ticket gurus, and their response tends to be, when they encounter criticism, to kind of embrace it and to kind of bring us into their sense making sphere so that we can have these discursive discussions with them. Chris,
I might describe it differently than Embrius. I would say they attempt to interpret the criticism in a way that they are just classifying you as, you know, basically in their case, if they can identify you as another type of sense maker or philosopher, whatever the case might be, then they feel that they have kind of dealt with the criticism because they've put you into this category. So they're very inviting to highlight that they agree with you. You know, lots of the things that you've talked about, these are real problems that they've noticed as well. But have you considered that your perspective is, you know, limited in these ways, X, Y, and Z, which actually makes us all just equally as guilty of everything that you're pointing out. And I'm not disparaging all sense makers, but just to say that I think that their embracing of the criticism is a lot more partial than that. And I, in terms of like people who respond, so what Matt said is absolutely true, that there are people for whom we don't even register the criticism. Although I suspect that a lot of them do notice at some point, in part because some people that they do like will often know about us or that kind of thing, or somebody will repeat something. So in many cases, they do show signs of like being aware to some extent. But I don't think there's any advantage in most occasions to speaking to us directly, because they would... Like, in most cases, whenever a guru person has dealt with a confrontational interview or an interview that is critical, even if it's not confrontational, they've regarded it as a terrible injustice that must be discussed for years to come, right? And they typically will not put themselves in that position, even with like big mainstream journalists, right? It's very rare. How many directly critical interviews of Jordan Peterson have there been? Everyone knows them because he's talked about them incessantly, right? The Kathy Newman and Helen Lewis, and more recently there was a Times interview which he also disparaged, or his debate with Destiny, right? But in that case, that was him interviewing Destiny, so it's slightly different there. But they don't want to be in the position of like being presented with critical feedback, and especially not in a scenario where they are not the person in control. So if they came on our podcast, they would be, you know, in part like having to deal with the fact that we are the people hosting them on the podcast. And actually the dynamics there would actually be helpful to them, but I think many of them don't think those things through enough. And then there's also the issue that, like, if you go on a podcast or engage with critics, you run the risk of essentially making your audience aware of critics that they otherwise wouldn't know about, right? Like, so you're strategically, your best option is to not engage at all with any criticism that you don't want people in your audience to be aware of, because like you can make vague reference to it. You can talk about the attacks that you'll receive, the slings and arrows, but you do not want to be pointing out to people, here is a detailed criticism of me coming from like a non-partisan political point of view. I think they're completely wrong, but you know, go and have a look. Like they never do that. They never do that. And you can tell that some people aren't gurish because in some occasions, people that we've covered would take that position that they, you know, they might not agree with things that we've said or whatever, but they would say, oh, these people have like done a critical episode, so, you know, check it out. But that is generally not the reaction of the people that score highly on the scale. Like we're just bad faith interlocutors, so why would you bother?
Matt and Chris, I really appreciate you making some time for me today. It was a really interesting conversation. If people want to learn more about the podcast, where would you direct them?
Decoding the Gurus is the name of the podcast. You can find that in the podcast players. On Twitter, we are, I don't remember any of this stuff. Chris, you tell them.
You are Arthur C. Dent, like the guy from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And I'm C_Kavanagh, I think, maybe. And there's the podcast, which is Gurus Pod. There's a lively Reddit subreddit, which is, I'm not sure I entirely recommend people to go there, but nonetheless, there is a subreddit where people are discussing our podcast sometimes, but mostly just gurus of various stripes and sometimes politics. But the podcast is the easy to find in all the usual places. And if you want to see Matt's prodigious research output, you can go look at Google Scholar. that's the other thing that you do.
Yep.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for putting out such an excellent and interesting podcast. And I hope we get the chance to talk again in the future.
Thanks so much, Peter.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Well, I really hope that you enjoyed the podcast as much as I did. If you found value in the show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. And now for the mandatory disclaimer. This podcast represents the opinions of Dr. Kelly and that of his guests. Content of the podcast should not be taken as psychological advice and is for general information only. Please consult your mental health professional for any specific questions around your psychological health. In no way does listening to our content establish a psychologist-client relationship. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors. All people, places, and scenarios mentioned in the podcast have been changed to protect patient confidentiality. Finally, this podcast should not be used in any legal capacity whatsoever, including but not limited to establishing a standard of care in a legal sense or as a basis for expert witness testimony. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions made on the podcast.